It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in just a bit, we'll learn how courts go about deciding whether to charge juveniles as adults in the wake of the recent stabbing case in Waukesha involving two 12-year-old girls.
First, there are a lot of famous tourist sites around the world, from the Statue of Liberty to the Great Pyramids. But our next guest veers off the beaten path, and in an online project, he's building a compendium of the world's wonders, curiosities, and esoterica.
Dylan Thuris joins us now. He's co-founder of Atlas Obscura. We've got a link to the project at the Central Time Facebook page. Dylan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Well, what kind of things do you try to compile there at the Atlas Obscura?
It's a wide range, and it's one of those things where you know it when you see it. we look for places that have a great story to tell, and it can be a place that's far-flung and very exotic, and it can be a place that's in your own backyard, and maybe you just didn't know the story behind it. It ranges quite a bit. But natural wonders, crazy outsider art projects, crypts, catacombs, that sort of stuff is pretty regular on the site.
Can you give us an example of one from your own life?
Sure, yeah. Well, I'm from the Midwest. I grew up in Minnesota, and I have a couple that are in Wisconsin that I would bring up because actually one of them was a real catalyst for me. When I was about 12, I went to what is a pretty well-known site in Wisconsin, although not necessarily well-known nationally or internationally, is the House on the Rock, which is one of the greatest, I think, one of the greatest collections, museums, just bizarre art and architecture projects in the country. I saw it on a road trip with my parents when I was about 12 years old, and it just opened a whole different world to me. I did not realize that places like this could exist. And since then, I really loved traveling to things of that nature. So in an interesting way, actually, the House on the Rock really set me down the path that I'm on now.
And you mentioned outsider art. Another Wisconsin thing that I think is on Atlas Obscura is the Forevertron, Dr. Evermore's salvage art exhibit.
Yeah, and that is another fantastic site. Actually, I got a chance to stop by there about a year ago. It was about 20 degrees below zero when I stopped by, so it was a fast visit. But it's a really what an incredible achievement that is. Really wonderful.
Well, looking further afield from Wisconsin, what are some places on your global travels that have really stuck out to you?
Yeah, so there's I'm always really excited. You know, this site is user generated, so people send in tips from all over the world, and we have an editorial team that looks into them and fact checks them. And once in a while, we get a tip that just we cannot believe we didn't know about it. And so there are a few that come to mind. One of them is a place in Turkmenistan called the Gates of Hell. And in the 1970s, a Russian drilling rig accidentally punctured a hole in the desert where they were drilling for natural gas and collapsed into it, creating this gigantic hole that was releasing natural gas. And so in an effort to sort of solve the problem, the Russian crew lit the hole on fire and basically left it there. And it is still burning today. It's over 300 feet wide. You can see it from Google Earth. It's just this massive flaming pit. And it's kind of just, it's unworldly. One of those strange locations.
That sounds like one that's best visited via the internet. Maybe one you don't want to, maybe can't see in person.
I think it's tough. Turkmenistan is not the easiest country to get into, and
that's maybe not on the Visit Turkmenistan catalog.
It is not on the Visit Turkmenistan catalog. Now, I actually believe the dictator of Turkmenistan has asked that they do something about it because it's sort of an embarrassment. Nothing's happened. It's still there, still burning, and I think we'll probably be that way for some time to come.
One thing that you guys recommend is sort of poking around, you know, maybe places you're not necessarily supposed to go, opening those doors that look obscure and seeing what's behind them. What kinds of things have you found by, going places you maybe shouldn't have gone or that weren't marked as obvious places to go?
I had one really interesting experience traveling in Italy, and this is a good example of where it's not necessarily about, you know, going somewhere you're not allowed to go, but actually sort of just following your curiosity a bit, and you might find something that really surprises you. So my wife and I were in a church in Bologna, and we were leaving, and we noticed there was sort of a door set into the wall with a little doorbell next to it. We thought, this is weird. What is this? So sort of got up the courage and rang the doorbell, and the door slid open. I guess it was on some kind of automated or some kind of like remote system. And we walked back into this sort of side chapel, and sitting in a golden throne was the 500-year-old saint relic of St. Catherine of Bologna, where that's how she was set, you know, 500 years ago, and there she sits today. Yeah. And so we found ourselves in this very intimate, very strange, kind of slightly overwhelming experience, just sitting in front of this sort of mummified saint. And that's a good example of kind of just letting your curiosity lead you to kind of down the half open doorway. I think usually you'll find that it's okay. You're not going to get in trouble. You might find something really incredible.
Before we get back to maybe some specific sites again, the Atlas Obscura project seems like it's as much about an attitude toward travel and exploration as the places you're cataloging themselves. How does this change the way we think about visiting a place?
For us, it's all about context and all about stories. And that's why we really stress that these places can be in your own backyard. I think it's easy to fall into a very well-worn paths. Whether it's when you're traveling, you're sort of, okay, I got to go see these five things that I know are the things to see in Paris or the things to see in New York. And same thing in your own city. You sort of follow the same narrow paths, and it can be hard to break out of that. But our hope is that by sort of reminding people that there's all kinds of hidden wonders close by, and that all it takes is to transform, you know, the house that's sort of the boring house you walk by every day into something totally magical is to know the story of the man who lived there for, you know, 50 years and collected every piece of anthropomorphic taxidermy ever created. And it changes the way you look at it. So our hope is that, you know, story is what makes places interesting. Whether you're traveling or at home, it's about the stories you tell to people. And that's what you bring back when you travel. So that's sort of the idea, is look at your world with a sense of wonder and possibility.
Well, you said that you were from Minnesota. And so if we want to discover more things that are in our neck of the woods, can you recommend some more unusual places that are in the Midwest here?
Yeah, I mean, it's a shameless plug, but in some ways I would say the best thing to do would be to go on. The site has, you know, approaching 10,000 different locations in it. So in some ways, the best thing is to go and sort of search, whether you're going to Minneapolis or going to another town, and look there. I'm trying to think of some good Minnesota. I mean, Minnesota has a great collection of questionable medical devices that is now a part of the Science Museum there, but it's a wonderful collection of quack items, crazy kinds of phrenology devices, and that's really worth checking out. So yeah, but there's a huge amount of stuff.
One of my random stops in, I can't remember if it was Minneapolis or St. Paul one time, was the headwaters of the Mississippi River. And it's just in a park downtown, and it doesn't look like much. It's not a lot of river there. But going there, you get a sense of like, hey, this thing turns into the Mississippi.
Yeah, yeah. And gives you a whole new perspective on something you might have passed by without even making note of it.
Yeah, it can be natural wonders, too. Mm-hmm. I remember driving by the San Andreas Fault and going, whoa, that's the San Andreas Fault. Sometimes it's what you know about it as much as the place.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, is there something that you or your team have chronicled, you haven't been there yet, that you want to see someday? And actually, one I'll mention that was on your list, at least online, was the Monument to the Lady Whacking Meteorite.
yeah, that's a good one. And I think that's in Alabama, not too far abroad. So Yeah, that's a great one. A woman was literally struck by a meteorite, I believe, in the 1950s. And it was such a bizarre and rare occurrence that there is a small monument acknowledging this bizarre event. She was fine. She had a large bruise on her thigh. So, but yeah, there's many places around the world that we would love to go see. I mean, one in particular, I would really love to go explore. There's a couple actually in India that are very high on my list. One is the Living Root Bridges, which are in the wettest part of India, and are two trees where the roots have been knitted together over a period of 10 to 15 years. There's a sort of small bridge is built, and they're given a chance to grow together, and the support structure is removed. And eventually what results is a living root bridge going over rivers. There's one that's sort of a double-decker root bridge with a top crossing and a bottom crossing, and I would really love to go see that in person.
I hope you do someday. Dylan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
That was Dylan Thuris. He's co-founder of Atlas Obscura. You can share your obscure sites on the world at the Atlas Obscura website. There's a link up at the Central Time Facebook page. Do you have a favorite site that you've gone off the beaten path to see, Veronica?
Well, just recently, my husband and I were poking around in Mineral Point on our anniversary trip, and we got to go inside the Badger Hole. So that means the place where the Cornish miners lived. Bored into the side of the rock is tiny little, kind of like a very rustic hobbit hole. It's just rock and floor. And it was crazy to think that somebody lived there.
My first week in Wisconsin, I went to a state park and I drove by a sign that said cow chip throw this weekend. And that's one of those times where I saw the sign and had to stop. And I'm glad I did. I saw the state record broken. It still hasn't been broken since.
Whoa.
243 feet, I believe, is our state record for a cow chip throw.
It's good to know.
Two 12-year-old girls in Waukesha were charged as an adult Monday in the attempted murder of another 12-year-old girl.
The case raises the wider question of how a court decides whether to charge juveniles as adults and when, in some cases, those decisions are reversed.
Here to help us understand that process is Devin Lee, legal counsel and juvenile practice group coordinator for the State Public Defender's Office. Devin, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what factors go into a decision for a court of whether to try a juvenile as an adult?
Well, what's interesting is that for some cases, they actually start in adult court. In other words, there's no discretion. So in some serious cases, like an attempted homicide or a first-degree intentional homicide, the case actually gets filed in adult court. And so then the court has to decide actually whether they're going to exercise discretion to return that child back to juvenile court.
And what is the age at which that starts, or the minimum age where there's that presumption that it goes straight to adult court in a violent case like that?
10 years old.
And then as far as deciding whether to charge a suspect as a juvenile or an adult, is it always that cut and dried, or are there cases where it's a prosecutor's discretion or a judge's discretion?
In Wisconsin, there actually isn't discretion. So by statute, in other words, by rule, certain cases start in adult court. Of relevance today, I think, is the attempted first-degree intentional homicide, and first-degree intentional homicide is automatically, there's no discretion on the part of the court or the prosecutor. It just gets charged in adult court. And then what happens is the child has a right to a hearing to present argument on certain factors as to why they should be returned to juvenile court. In other words, why the adult court should send the case to juvenile court.
And what kind of factors go into that decision if that is challenged? Prior criminal record, for example, is that something that gets considered in whether to throw it back from adult court to juvenile system?
It's not. There are actually three particular factors that a child would have to prove by a preponderance of the evidence, or in common parlance, it's just sort of 51%. And those three factors are, first, that if the child were convicted in adult court, they would not be able to receive adequate treatment in the adult system. Second is that transferring jurisdiction to the juvenile court would not depreciate the seriousness of the offense. And finally, the third factor that the court considers is whether retaining jurisdiction in adult court is necessary to deter that juvenile or other juveniles from committing the same sort of crime.
Now, are there cases that go the other way where the initial presumption is somebody under a certain age starts off in the juvenile system, but then for whatever reason it gets moved up to the adult system?
There is. For a lot of cases, there are situations where the case starts in juvenile court, and the state can move to have that juvenile tried in adult court. And that's a situation where there's often a hearing where both sides present evidence and the court considers whether to send the juvenile to adult court.
And when would the state think about doing something like that? When would the court system think about moving a juvenile into the adult system?
That's a good question. I think that sometimes has to do with the seriousness of the offense, how old the child is. In other words, you know, in Wisconsin, our age of adult jurisdiction is 17. So if you have a child who is maybe 16 and has a history of serious offenses, then the state might want to have that child moved to adult court. You know, one of the things that there's sort of a number of factors that the court would consider if they wanted to send a child to adult court, and that's something about the child, the child's personality, the child's history, mental health, sort of what is the nature of the offense, was it violent and aggressive, what things are available in juvenile court for that kind of child, and then whether it makes sense to have the whole case go up to adult court. So it's slightly different factors from what they consider when the case starts in adult court.
And you mentioned the age 17 as when you're just an adult and you go to adult court. I seem to remember there have been efforts to move that age up to 18. Where has that left off?
That's correct. Well, nationally, there's been a move in some states to have juvenile jurisdiction remain through 17. And in New York, for example, it's actually 16. And I think there's a recognition in general that children's brains are not fully developed, even at 17. And because even though a 17-year-old may look physically mature, their brain really is not mature. And what we're learning now is that our brains don't develop until we're into our 20s. So I think there's a recognition of that. And I think there's been some support for that same concept in Wisconsin.
Is that part of the philosophy behind the idea of putting somebody in a juvenile court versus an adult court, this idea of brain development, and that at that stage in brain development, somebody isn't as culpable, as ultimately responsible for actions as somebody who's older and theoretically their brain is more developed?
I think that's certainly true. You know, it's been interesting. Over the last 10 years or so, our U.S. Supreme Court has actually started looking at the studies that have been done in brain development, and scientists have actually used MRIs to scan children's brains over years to sort of see how they develop. And what they've learned is that the frontal lobe, which sort of controls, you know, how we think about things and our ability to look at risk, isn't fully developed. And so children use different parts of their brains to make decisions about risk. And the U.S. Supreme Court has taken that into consideration and said, you know, this means that children are less morally culpable, that they're more open to rehabilitation, and that, you know, the acts that they commit as children don't necessarily reflect on who they'll be as an adult.
And that's one of the arguments that goes back and forth in this issue sometimes, too, is that if you've got somebody aged 10 to 17 and you give them an adult-style sentence, they're basically starting life at age 40, 45, 50, when they actually get out of prison.
That's true. And there's also some studies that show that children who are treated as adults are more likely to reoffend down the road. In other words, the programs that are available in juvenile court, which focus on rehabilitation, mental health services, educational services, actually make the community safer in the long run than, you know, sort of this locking kids up until, as you say, they're 40 or 50 and then trying to start their lives.
We're talking to Devin Lee about how courts decide whether to charge juveniles as adults, the question prompted by the case in Waukesha, the stabbing, the alleged offenders, age 12, charged earlier this week as adults.
And if you have general questions about how the justice and juvenile justice system work, we hope to hear from you. You can reach us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post your questions on the Central Time Facebook page.
Music.
talking with Devin Lee, Legal Counsel and Juvenile Practice Group Coordinator for the State Public Defender's Office, about how the courts decide when to charge juveniles as adults.
Discussion coming up because of the case in Waukesha involving two alleged 12-year-old attempted homicide suspects. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have experience working in the court system as a prosecutor, a defender, judge, or somebody who works in social services? What have you seen? What goes into the decision of whether to charge a minor as an adult or not? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can send an email, talk@WPR.org. Devin, you had touched on before the news where the kids go if they're found guilty and they go into the incarceration system. How do you weigh the costs and benefits of taking a minor and putting them in an adult system where there's no services for them, as you said, versus putting a violent offender in the juvenile justice system, the incarceration system, that may not be able to handle a very violent offender?
You know, I think that's a fair question. And I guess I see it this way. You know, when a crime that's sort of shocking is committed, I think there's no clear answer what's going to be best for a particular child, because I think we start asking ourselves, you know, why did this happen? You know, what does this mean for this person and for this community, and how do we keep our community safe, et cetera, all these natural questions. And I think one thing that we need to recognize is that the juvenile justice system is actually designed in Wisconsin to handle everything from, you know, the kid who steals, you know, Cheetos from the gas station, or sort of these low-level offenses, all the way up to the most significant offenses. And our juvenile system has the tools to provide safety to the community and also provide support to these children. I think I had mentioned that, you know, children who are retained in the juvenile system, actually there are better outcomes for both the individual children and for the community. And so, you know, with children who are placed in our juvenile prison, for example, have access to mental health counseling, they have access to education, they certainly are held accountable. They are behind bars for all intents and purposes, not unlike if they're kept in the adult system. So in terms of, you know, sort of that punishment aspect, in some ways they're sort of identical, but the advantage to the juvenile system is that you have the support and this rehabilitation focus for children, but they're certainly being held accountable.
We'll go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Amy on the line in Appleton. Amy, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up, Amy?
Well, I just wanted to bring up the point that I really think we do need to differentiate between violent crimes and nonviolent crimes. I'm 30 years old now, but when I was 15, I was charged with possession of a very small amount of marijuana, but I was charged as an adult, and I very honestly had to take classes and many other things where I hung out with people who were, you know, a lot worse off than I was, per se, and kind of got me around, you know, a group of people that I probably wouldn't have been, and it was not good for me at the time. So it really had an impact on my life. I've luckily turned everything around and am doing well, but I just wanted to bring that up.
Well, Amy, congratulations on a happy outcome in the long run. But Devin, is that normal nowadays, at least for somebody under the age of 18 to be charged as an adult for nonviolent drug crimes?
I think certainly for someone under 17, it would be unusual to charge someone as an adult for a drug crime. And again, I think there's a recognition that children are different. They're not mini adults. You know, there's sort of this adult time for adult crime, and really children don't commit adult crimes. They commit, as children, crimes that are disturbing, horrific, et cetera. But, you know, as Amy is saying, we want kids to be able to have that second chance to move forward with their lives unburdened by a criminal conviction, by having everything be public. You know, that impacts on their future education, job prospects, et cetera.
Is there a change over time there where, I think it was about 15 years ago, Amy said she was charged as an adult at age 15? Is that something that the system is moving away from?
I think it is. You know, we were talking about the waiver from juvenile court into adult court, and certainly that can happen today. But I think there has been a movement toward recognizing that children are different. And again, you know, when our U.S. Supreme Court, which is not, you know, sort of a radical court, is recognizing the science that says, you know, children are literally using different parts of their brains than adults, and we didn't realize this before, and we didn't realize that when a child, you know, is involved in a drug offense or other offense, it doesn't mean that they're going to do this forever, you know, but that kids do change, that their personalities are not set in stone.
And Amy's story makes me think of another issue I wanted to bring up. The safety of someone under 17 ending up in adult prison, does that factor into whether they're charged as adult and how sentencing works if they are?
What happens in Wisconsin is that even if a child is convicted in adult court, they're held at the juvenile prison until they are 17, and then they can be moved to an adult institution. So there's federal law that prevents children from being housed with adults, whether it's in a county jail or in a prison. And so in Wisconsin, that's why we actually house children with other children.
And one side question, in the juvenile system, if someone's charged as a juvenile, not an adult, are there more non-incarceration alternatives out there available?
There absolutely are. We have sort of a number of placements for children. They may be placed with a foster home. They may be placed in a group home. They can be placed in a what's called a juvenile treatment facility. It can be, it's generally unlocked, intensive treatment, all the way up to, you know, then our juvenile prison.
We'll leave it there for now. Devin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Devin Lee. She's legal counsel and juvenile practice coordinator at the State Public Defender's Office, helping us to get to know how the courts decide whether to try juveniles as adults. When we're growing up, a lot of us learned a musical instrument like piano, trumpet, guitar. Then we get older. We choose careers other than music and let this instrument sit in the basement getting dusty, or maybe it hits the garage sale. Our next guest says it's important to keep on making music, even if we're not pros, and she's figured out some good ways to make room in our lives for it.
Stephanie Elkins joins us now. She's a music host here at Wisconsin Public Radio. You can catch her Sunday nights at 5 on Simply Folk. She's also an amateur musician. Stephanie, welcome back.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me again.
So, Stephanie, can you make the case for us that even though we have day jobs of nothing to do with music, that we should keep on making music, not just listening to it?
Yeah, I can make the case personally, but there's also a lot of research behind it that making music makes you feel good, and not just at that moment, but it can lift your spirits emotionally, psychologically, and it impacts the whole rest of your life. So it's something that if you can squeeze it in, it really, really makes a difference.
Well, let's get to squeezing it in, because I think some people might be listening saying, sounds lovely if I had the time. How do we make time for music?
Well, a couple things you can do. One thing that we did at home is just leave the instruments out. You know, if you have a nice guitar, don't leave it in the case. It might need to have a little bit of, you know, humidifier or something like that to take care of it, but leave it out. We have a mandolin and we have percussion instruments and we have stuff that's just finally now in the living room. I used to be a neat freak and a perfectionist and everything would be put away. But now that it's there, you can actually pick it up and play whenever you feel like it. And sometimes that's 5 minutes during a commercial on TV or, you know, when the pasta is coming to a boil.
Yeah, it's interesting. One deterrent, I think, for people, and this includes me, is that if it's been a while, you don't want to play because you're going to sound terrible and it's demoralizing and you or your neighbors are going to complain. How do we get past that initial, I sound terrible at this, I shouldn't be playing it?
Well, I think that's a common phenomenon, especially since we hear so much beautiful music, recorded music. But you just have to get over that and you have to be okay with it. And especially if you have kids, you want to give them the example of it's okay not to be perfect. It's okay to practice and learn and just improve and have it be an important part of your life no matter how it sounds.
And you're saying that because we hear so much perfect studio music, it might sound even harsher to our ears when really, you know, nothing sounds that pristine.
Well, and if you think about that, we've been making music for centuries, millennia, in villages, and, you know, we would do these dances, and everybody was expected to learn how to play a fiddle or at least sing a few songs. And it's only been this century, or not this century, but the last maybe 120 years or so, when we've had recorded music that all of a sudden we've stopped doing this. We don't get together like we used to. It used to be a community bonding thing, a family bonding thing, and we've given up that for some reason, and it really needs to take a more important part in our lives.
Well, how about that as a social element, apart from just practicing at home? Is that part of the solution here, getting together and having hootenannies or something?
You bet. Absolutely. And I say that because we do it at home. And for instance, when our friends come over to the house, they know to bring a guitar or bring an instrument. My brother-in-law made a songbook, and so we get that thing out, and everybody has the same pages and the same chords. And it doesn't matter if it sounds bad, and it doesn't matter if the harmonies sounds not quite right. The point is it's community building, it's family building. It's really healthy on so many levels.
Plus, you get to use the word hootenanny again, which is worth it almost just for that alone.
There are hootenannies all over Wisconsin. I mean, the folk community does this routinely. And there are, you can find places to play with in community groups. And not only that, it's summertime. So now there are community bands starting up. There are community choruses. So there are lots of opportunities.
Well, part of the thing that's going on, I think, is a lot of us have outsourced creativity to other people, whether we're talking about music or writing or art, you name it, and not embracing the role of the amateur. And we talked about that just a little bit before the show. Can you make amateur a happy word for us again?
Oh, yes. Well, the root of that word is from the Latin amor, or love, and it just means love. A love of music, love of whatever you're an amateur at is a really good thing, and it's fine to be an amateur. And it reflects simply that you have a connection with whatever your art form is. You know, I think people that do visual arts, it's the same thing. If you leave your paints out, you're going to paint more, and you're an amateur, but you still love it. It sustains you. It helps you. It makes you feel good. And so many of us, we outsource, right? We buy somebody else's art. We buy somebody else's music. And we forget that the creative process is something that feeds our spirits. It feeds our emotional life. And it's really, really important.
Yeah, and Stephanie, you and I got the idea for this segment when we were chatting at work one day, and you have a really cool ritual. You found a way to make space for this. It sounds like you and your husband, every Saturday morning, you get up and you play music together.
That's right. And we are amateurs. We obviously don't do this for money. But with a cup of coffee, often still in our pajamas, he'll sit at the piano, I get my guitar out, we sing, sometimes we do old standards, sometimes we write music. We've written a lot of songs. And, you know, they're not great, they're just for us. And it's something that, you know, marriages have their ebbs and flows, and it's a glue that keeps us really close, and it also allows for a lot of emotions that you can't necessarily put words to have an opportunity to come through and be present.
You know, having the instrument out really, now that you mention it, that makes a difference. My main instrument is saxophone. I practice that. It's a little bit of work. But I have a flute. And if I leave it assembled, not in the case, there's the flute. Play it a little bit, horribly, try not to pass out because it uses so much more air. And if it's sat in the case, and it's sat in there for a year now, I think. And then I had my old 1980s synthesizer in the basement. A couple of the keys don't work. It did nothing for a long time. Put it in the kids' room, plugged it into an app, and they play it every day.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just so, it's as simple as not putting things away.
It is. And you just have to be comfortable with the fact that your surroundings are going to reflect this love of music. And that's okay. You just have to own that. You know, when people come over to the house and we have these things all around, we're in the middle of another music project. That's just how it is. Where, you know, 10 years ago, I would have been freaking out and trying to put everything away. But it is something that really, you know, before radio, I had a pretty heavy corporate job. And that weekly, you sang with a chorus for a little while, for a long while. And that weekly choral rehearsal was my therapy. I would go home high as a kite and feeling really good. And that's when I finally got it, that it's more than just the music.
Yeah, such a good case. It's a good reminder. I have in my instrument graveyard, I have a trombone and a cornet, and those probably no one should ever hear me play again. But I can actually play the piano, and I can actually sing, and I'm not doing those things, even though I do have a piano in my living room. So what's the impetus, Stephanie, for just doing it? You just sit down no matter where you are and just go?
Well, I think it's a form of self-love in a way. So you just have to figure out that this is something that makes you feel good and you're just going to allocate time for it. And when you start doing it on a regular basis, I now am committed to doing it about 6 days a week. And really, that's only 5 or 10 minutes a day. I just want to keep my guitar calluses. That's really where it comes down to, because it's so, it hurts so much if you don't, if you have to keep starting over. But, you know, you sing and I sing, and you were talking about the sax and the flute. Those are all things that require deep breathing. And that's another reason why it elevates you. It elevates your spirit. It elevates you, you know, physiologically. And so when you make music with yourself and especially with others, it is feeding you in ways that impact the whole rest of your life. You know, I become less irritable. I become friendlier. So it's, you know, it's one of those things that benefits not just me, but everybody around me.
Well, now we've been pitching this largely to people who, you know, maybe used to play back in high school band or whatever. What about people who never started with music? Can you make the case that they should leap this even bigger hurdle? They've never started in the first place.
Absolutely. I have met seniors who are starting to learn recorder for the first time. You know, it's a little instrument and it's easy to play and it's not too loud. And for instance, they're at the University of Wisconsin here in Madison. They have a summer class series and they use the undergrad and graduate students to be the instructors. It gives them practice in teaching. And it also provides a community service, kind of the Wisconsin idea. And I think I just saw that the deadline for those classes is coming up this Friday. But that's a way, if you've never done anything, you can find what resources are around through your university, through your technical colleges, and get started.
And Stephanie, sing-alongs are a good way to go. In our last minute here, you have occasionally done the sing-along Simply Folk evenings, and those have been pretty popular. Tell us about that resource and what people get out of it.
Oh, that is absolutely the most popular program on Simply Folk. And every time I do it, they'll say, can you just do it again next week? But there's something, in fact, we have listening parties around the state for the sing-along show where people get together and the lyrics are posted. In fact, there might be a
they're
link
on the Central Time Facebook page right now.
Excellent. There are 40 songs there that you can sing along with, kids, adults, every age. And I think that's the appeal, is that anybody can do it. And you can sing She's Been Coming Around the Mountain or Puff the Magic Dragon or Where Have All the Flowers Gone, traditional old songs, Shenandoah, things like that. And share something together, share a moment together. And it's something, again, that feeds the spirit and makes you feel good.
Great. Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome.
We've been talking to Stephanie Elkin. She's an amateur musician and music host here at Wisconsin Public Radio. You can catch her Sunday nights at 5 o'clock on Simply Folk.